Hi, Hannah Devlin here. Before we start the show, this year the Guardian and Observer charity appeal is dedicated to raising money for youth homelessness and poverty among asylum seekers. These charities provide accommodation and crucial services to those without a permanent home. Please help some of Britain's most vulnerable people and donate by calling 0151 284 1126 or visit guardian.charitiestrust.org.
The Guardian.
I'm pretty boring myself, so I gotta spice it up a little by seducing you with some free human CRISPR DNA and scotch.
Following his PhD, Josiah Zainer landed his dream job as a synthetic biologist at NASA, but he quickly became frustrated with the pace of innovation within a large institution.
I want you to interrupt me, or if you think I'm stupid, just yell at me a little bit.
So he quit, and he founded a company that would see him become the poster boy of the biohacking movement.
So, my name is Josiah Zainer, and I run a company called The Odin.
In October of this year, Zainer live-streamed a lecture from San Francisco, in which he claimed to have become the first person to have edited his own genome using CRISPR technology.
Are you suggesting maybe I should try it?
And to back up this claim, he injected himself live on camera with a concoction that he claimed would delete a gene that inhibits muscle growth.
What we got here is some DNA.
Zainer claims that anyone can do this with one of his company's gene engineering kits.
To me, the scary things really are like people not having access to this technology.
But is there any scientific evidence to suggest that this DIY approach to gene editing actually works? Is the technology safe? And ultimately, does this kind of self-experimentation drive the science forward, or does it expose the public to unacceptable risks?
I think one of the interesting things about science and technology right now is how fast it's moving. But when it's sort of in the academic and industrial realm, there's so many regulations that prevent it from, I think, helping people.
Part of me really likes the enthusiasm and the drive of wanting to take this technology and run with it, absolutely. But I'm really reticent to say that I think it's the best way to go about it, to be honest.
You might think that, it is a consumer choice issue, and if consumers want to voluntarily take on the risks of attempting enhancement, then that's their choice, and we shouldn't worry so much about the risks. And I don't think there's been a clearly articulated philosophy from regulators on how they're going to treat enhancement products.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Okay. Pardon. Sorry, this is Josiah real quick. Hey, Patty, what's up?
We started by asking the very person who's leading the charge within this biohacking movement.
My name is Josiah Zainer, and I am founder and CEO of The Odin.
I spoke with Josiah via Skype recently, and joining us both down the line to provide some legal context was Professor Patty Zettler.
And I'm an associate professor at Georgia State University College of Law in Atlanta in the United States.
And in the studio?
My name's Ganesh Taylor, and I'm a postdoctoral training fellow at the Francis Crick Institute in London.
Josiah, you used to work as a biochemist for NASA, but you decided to quit and start your company. What were your thoughts behind that decision, and what's the overall goal of The Odin?
NASA was kind of my dream, and I think it's like every kid's little dream to work for a space agency. It sounds so cool. But as the problem is with a lot of government agencies, there was just so much bureaucracy and things preventing me from getting the science and research done that I thought should get done. I thought there perhaps was a better way. So I decided to leave and start a company that provides people, just normal consumers, with the ability to do genetic engineering and synthetic biology in their own homes.
Okay, and you recently did a lecture live on Facebook where you claimed to have edited your own genome in your kitchen using CRISPR technology. Could you just tell us a bit more about that? What gene you were targeting and whether you've noticed any effects since then?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things about science and technology right now is how fast it's moving. But when it's sort of in the academic and industrial realm, there's so many regulations that prevent it from, I think, you know, helping people. Now, CRISPR is this technology that was discovered in about 2011 and 2012, and it allows people to edit genomes of organisms, including humans, fairly easily. But to this date, it hasn't been ever used on human beings. It's been used on basically every other organism, including primates, besides humans. And that kind of, I guess, boggled my mind. So I decided to see how difficult it would be to do an experiment to try to edit my own genome using CRISPR. So I designed a CRISPR system to target a gene called myostatin, which when it is modified, it allows muscle to grow in the human body. So when it's functioning normally, it prevents your body from growing muscle. But I did the experiment of getting this DNA, designing the DNA, ordering it, purifying it to a high purity, and then injecting it into my muscle for under $500. The results at this time are pretty inconclusive, whether it worked or not. But it's not really a technical problem whether it will work, because we've already done similar experiments in, you know, other primates. It's just getting the system to work in a more non-commercial or non-professional environment.
Josiah makes it sound easy, but as a scientist who works with CRISPR in the lab, Ganesh Taylor doesn't completely agree with him.
Injecting the DNA components of the CRISPR-Cas9 system into your general subcutaneous muscular area is not sufficient to remotely think that you're going to actually be able to A, modify the gene of interest successfully, B, cause a mutation that's severe enough for the gene to stop working, C, to do that in sufficient numbers of cells to even make a single whole muscular structure be modified. And even if you were managed, like were able to do that, to be able to extend that beyond a singular muscle or piece of muscle in your arm to the rest of your body requires a lot of delivery, actually. It's a real delivery problem.
Oh, totally. I wasn't trying to do my whole body, just a small local injection with DNA that was encapsulated in PEI polyplexes. The DNA contained both the Cas9 enzyme and the gRNA that targeted the myostatin gene, so it would undergo non-homologous end joining to have an indel in there. So
I don't want to go too deeply into the kind of technicalities right at the start, because not all of our listeners will have kind of followed the intricacies of, you know, CRISPR, but Ganesh, why is it more than just a question of injecting it into your arm and then expecting to turn into a Hulk?
I'm really sorry. To give a really full answer to this, I feel like I have to kind of explain the magnitude of what a genome is initially, if that's okay, very simply, and also, therefore, how CRISPR-Cas9 works. And that's kind of the answer to your question. So a genome is like an instruction manual that takes a single cell from the beginning of life to a full adult organism with the millions and billions of cells in it, okay? The instruction manual, therefore, is incredibly detailed. Many, many instructions, many, many pages. So when we talk about CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing, this technology has been sort of suggested to work a bit like a search and find function in a Word microprocessor. So imagine a huge digital instruction manual and you just type in myostatin, and then all of a sudden that instruction pops up and you just hit delete and it's gone. That's the picture that's painted. The reality of how the system actually works is it's not like that at all. So there's two parts. There's one part that is sort of user defined, where you effectively provide a molecule that looks for a certain section a 20 base pair section, actually, quite a small section, of the gene of interest. And then you feed it to another protein called the Cas9, which does cutting. And it just cuts. It's like a pair of scissors, right? It just cuts DNA. So when we say that we've edited a gene, what actually happened is we've provided a molecule, a 20 base pair molecule, sent this pair of scissors to the location, and then it's cut. And what happens after that point actually is completely up to chance. So currently there's a lot of research being done into how to take that random chance event of breaking DNA into being something that we want it to be. And so actually what happens, even if you manage to introduce the pieces of DNA respectively, as in this case is so, or if you have the actual protein, the actual molecule itself, even if you can get that into the cells, once it cuts, what happens at that point actually is completely random and happens differently in every single cell. So whilst in some cells you might actually be able to completely disrupt the gene by breaking the DNA at that point, and then in the fixing process the cell accidentally removes the whole page of that book by accident or whatever it is that it's doing, the neighboring cell might just repair it just the same, or accidentally fuse it to a completely different gene, and all of a sudden you're making tons and tons of this gene as opposed to not having it at all. So a lot of these experiments actually are generally done on single cells as opposed to generally being sort of injected into the middle of biological nowhere.
It's not clear whether Josiah's experiment will have had any impact on the DNA inside his muscles. Nevertheless, the publicity stunt prompted warnings from the scientific community, including one of Britain's leading geneticists, Robin Lovell-Badge, who claimed the experiment was foolish.
Not my colleague. Yeah, no, Robert.
I asked Ganesh if she agreed.
I have to say, I think actually as a millennial and a young researcher, part of me really likes the enthusiasm and the drive of wanting to take this technology and run with it, absolutely. But I'm really reticent to say that I think it's the best way to go about it, to be honest. You know, the word experiment actually has connotations, like, for example, you have a control and that you sort of have some method of actually assaying what's going on. And whilst part of me thinks, oh, wow, it'll be really interesting to see what happens, to turn one's own body into a sort of experiment is questionable at the best of times. But when there's no proper control methods and there's no real method of assaying whether or not it's working, actually it's more likely to do Josiah damage himself than actually any kind of scientific good per se.
Like, there are assays that I'm doing to be able to detect this. And it's interesting when scientists say that, like, an experiment requires all these different things. Like, there is a control. It's my other arm, which wasn't injected. And not only that, there was a recent paper published in Nature that showed that an individual with a skin disease who is genetically modified, a single individual, and he was cured. Nobody argues that there was only one subject. Nobody argues that, oh, well, there weren't real scientific principles going on behind this. It seems really strange when scientists bring up all these things that they themselves do. I mean, Nobel Prizes have been won by people who've experimented on themselves. I think people like to single out me because I'm outside of the traditional institutions. So to say that I'm not a scientist or doing things in a scientific manner, like, they can find the research I've done online, the reviews of the work, and why this isn't technically feasible. They can look at the data when I publish it, right? I always put out the data on the experiments that I do.
Whether or not these gene engineering kits are safe and effective, they are now available to buy online. Something I wanted to know was whether that's legal. And so I asked Patty Zettler what the current situation is in the States.
You know, in short, it depends. So FDA recently issued a warning on its website about the self-administration of gene therapies, in which it basically said the sale of gene therapy products intended for self-administration violates the law. So basically what FDA is saying is that if there's a person out there who chooses to purchase a gene therapy product or gene therapy kit and administer it to themselves, it's not the person who's violating the law or violating regulations. It's the company that's marketing the product. So to that extent, FDA is not regulating what individuals choose to do, but FDA does regulate the marketing of products for self-administration.
Josiah, has that changed what you're doing in any way? And have you had any contact with the FDA about that warning that they posted?
No, I haven't had any contact with the FDA. We're not really selling any items for people to actually directly inject into their body.
Could I just ask, you said that you're not selling products for people to inject or modify their own genome. What are you selling then?
We sell DNA, just like everybody else. There are a lot of companies that sell DNA for CRISPR. They're for use on human cell lines. Obviously, human cells exist in humans just as much as they can exist in a petri dish. The DNA, while somebody could try and inject it, it wouldn't do much or anything. It's not mixed with the proper chemicals. It's not high enough concentration. So we provide people with the tools in order to do biotechnology research. There are many companies that do this. We're not the only ones. We just tell people how it can be used.
So I think, you know, what's interesting about the Odin and other companies doing similar things is that, you know, under U.S. law, whether something is a drug subject to FDA's authority depends on whether it's intended to address disease or intended to affect the structure or function of the body. So that's actually a really broad definition, in that many, many things can fall under that. So the question isn't, does the company specifically say this gene therapy kit or these tools are for treating X, Y, or Z? The question is sort of more a holistic, is everything the company doing suggesting that the company intends this to be used as a human gene therapy product? So, you know, disclaimers that this is only for research use, or disclaimers that a company doesn't intend people to inject themselves might not be enough to get them out from under FDA's oversight. If you look at the whole big picture, it seems like the company is really intending the product to be used as a human gene therapy product.
It would seem then that DIY gene editing falls into a grey area where people are free to experiment on themselves, but companies are, in theory, prohibited from encouraging this. After this short break, we'll explore how lawmakers are trying to strike a balance between the choice of individuals to modify themselves and safety concerns over these new technologies.
You know, I do think that products like gene therapies do pose risks for consumers that go beyond standard consumer products that fall outside of FDA's jurisdiction.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from Josiah Zahner, who told us about his enthusiasm for editing his own genome using CRISPR, a choice he claims should be available to everyone, regardless of their scientific background. But not everyone agrees. Ganesh Taylor, a scientist who works with CRISPR in the lab, questions both the efficacy and the safety of Josiah's approach.
There are ways around self-modification. I mean, there are things that we can do.
We also heard from Patty Zettler about the current regulations surrounding these kinds of gene editing technologies. Patty told us that the regulations are aimed not at individuals, but at companies. I wanted to know the extent to which these laws accommodate personal freedom to self-modify.
Yeah, that's a good question. There are certainly lots of things, as you pointed out, that we do to modify our bodies that we don't think of as drugs, or FDA does not regulate as drugs or devices. Wearing a sweater keeps me warm, and that affects the function of my body, but a sweater is not regulated by the FDA. But, you know, I do think that products like gene therapies do pose risks for consumers that go beyond standard consumer products that fall outside of FDA's jurisdiction. And I think because the technology is so new, there is concern about unleashing it onto the public without proper oversight. And history has suggested that many medical or quasi-medical products that are marketed without oversight have very little data to back them up. And that's also concerning. Even if there aren't risks to consumers or patients, if patients or consumers forego things that are effective for something that is not effective, you know, that's a risk too.
But if it's not being something that's marketed to patients with an illness, say, if it's just something to boost your muscle size, isn't that a personal choice that people ought to be able to make?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really challenging question for regulators, what to do about products intended for enhancement of healthy individuals versus addressing diseases or conditions in unhealthy individuals. You know, on the one hand, you might think, well, the benefits of enhancement are significantly less than a treatment or a cure for a disease, and so we want the risks of those products to be lower, and we want to actually be more careful about those products. Or you might think that, you know, it is a consumer choice issue, and if consumers want to voluntarily take on the risks of attempting enhancement, then that's their choice, and we shouldn't worry so much about the risks. And I don't think there's been a clearly articulated philosophy from regulators on how they're going to treat enhancement products.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institutet has today decided to award the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for 2005 jointly to Dr. Barry J. Marshall and J. Robin Warren for their discovery of the bacterium Helicobacter pylori and its role in gastritis and peptic ulcer disease.
Ganesh, I was interested in you before saying, you know, as a millennial, part of you sort of applauds this approach. Do you think that there should be a role for self-experimentation in science? And do you think it can, you know, lead to genuine, credible scientific breakthroughs?
Oh yeah, as Josiah said, it has previously been the case for sure. I mean, the famous case is the chap who discovered H. pylori, the bacterium that gives you stomach ulcers and cancer eventually, potentially, and he ingested it. And famously, Morgan, who established the fruit fly as a model, also ingested his flies at various points in their lives. So it's not unheard of, and absolutely, so the scientific wheel is very slow to turn sometimes, and publications can be slow, and I can totally sympathize with the frustrations of wanting to do stuff with the tools that we have. And for sure, there's a lot more enthusiasm, I think, amongst new sort of younger scientists for what we can do with these tools, which are truly amazing. However, all of that said, I think it's really important to remember that we don't really know everything there is to know about what our genomes do or how they work or any of that, actually, nor do we fully appreciate how CRISPR-Cas9 really fully works. And so whilst some people might think, well, it doesn't matter, I'll go with a bit more of an ad hoc approach to that, it has to be said that we don't really know what's going to happen or how it's going to pan out, and we can't necessarily get all those wonderful effects that we hope for just yet, because we don't know how it happens in the first place, let alone how to make it so using these tools.
Josiah, you are obviously aware of the possibility that, you know, the injection may not have done fully exactly what, you know, you hoped it would do, and that there might be risks around this stuff. As you're a trained scientist, I wonder whether the people buying the products from your company, whether you get a sense of
whether they're well informed about the risks and what they're using it for. You know, are they injecting it?
Oh, no. I mean, I go through moral and ethical dilemmas all the time about whether people could possibly end up hurting themselves doing similar stuff. I mean, there have been other people recently who started attempting to genetically modify themselves publicly. And, you know, I felt like they didn't fully understand what they were doing to themselves. Part of me is really hesitant about allowing people to do this stuff. But it's hard because you can go out and you can smoke a cigarette, which you know has a high percentage of giving you cancer if you smoke for the rest of your life, right? If you drive a car, you know that there's a chance that you could die in a traffic accident, and you know millions of people die across the world every year because of cars. I think it's possible that people will do stupid stuff, but I don't think that that's the thing we should be focusing on. I think we should be focusing on what are the possible benefits of this technology? What are the possible benefits of the technology when used properly? Because there are so many technologies, from a kitchen knife to throwing a TV at somebody, that can be used for harm, but we continue to use them because of the amazing benefit that they have in our lives.
I mean, you've kind of made the libertarian argument around, you know, people should be free to smoke or do what they want, but it's not an entirely neutral point of view when it, you know, it comes to the companies marketing these things. And if you have, maybe not your company, but maybe there will be other companies that are going to be, you know, really pushing to commercialize this stuff and encouraging people to take risks. What would you say to that?
I think that's for the government to figure out. I don't think that anybody should put me in charge of the government, because as you said, I'm fairly libertarian, and I would probably just say, hey, let's see what happens. Let's take a free market approach to this. But I mean, society survived before the FDA, and I'm sure we'll survive after it when things change and when there's no FDA anymore in the year 2100. So I think in the end, what it's about is not necessarily, like I said, it's not necessarily about will people hurt themselves, will people do stupid stuff. People don't need a reason to do stupid stuff, right? What they need is something that could help them, could save lives, could engineer crops. They need things that will help improve their life.
So I completely agree with Josiah that there are all kinds of products out there that are incredibly risky and that people make bad choices. I make bad choices. We all make bad choices. And there's no way to stop that. But I think one way to view the FDA's role in these kinds of products is not just as consumer protection, but as actually incentivizing the kind of innovation that we want, that the free market, history has shown us, does not work really for products that consumers can't judge for themselves. Consumers don't know if a drug works or gene therapy works when they try it on themselves. You know, we really need data to understand whether things work. And the only way to, or maybe not the only way, but the way we've devised to incentivize companies to spend the money to develop the data to prove that what they're saying is actually true or true enough is to have FDA play a gatekeeping role. You know, I think there is a case that FDA actually helps us get the kind of innovative products we want rather than a market of, you know, 90% total crap and, you know, 10% things that might work.
Whether Josiah's technology can be used for self-modification remains to be seen. But with more than 1,000 of his DIY CRISPR kits sold, there's clearly some public appetite for this kind of self-experimentation. I asked Josiah what's next for him and his company.
I think my main goal is not necessarily to do stunts. Obviously, that blew up a lot bigger than I anticipated. But my main goal is to make this technology available to people. To me, this is literally the first time in human history where we can modify our genetics through gene therapy. It's been done in humans since the 1990s. this is the first time we can modify our genetics for personal reasons, for cosmetic reasons, for whatever reason you want. That's so powerful to me that people can do what they want with their own genetics. I couldn't think of a more, like, better way to provide equality, to provide liberty to people. And that's just what I want to promote. That's just what I want to do. The stunts and everything like that, you know, gets you to give me a call, and then I can, you know, spout my rhetoric, and hopefully it all works out in the end.
Ganesh, I can see you shaking your head for part of that. Why?
Because as much as I love that, I really do, I wouldn't be a biologist, I wouldn't be studying what it is to be a human by taking a look at our DNA and working out all the gene networks and how they function in different ways. And all my colleagues are doing that, and we have this huge thing called science that works towards that. And absolutely, we wouldn't be doing that if we didn't want to use it to improve human life. Completely. Can't emphasize how much enthusiasm and love there is for that. But we don't have those answers yet. And people, just by being given the basic premise, oh, find any 20 letters of a gene you want to edit, and here is a Cas9 sequence, isn't going to result in anybody actually being able to do those things in that way, because we're bodies, we're biological organisms that are incredibly complicated. I can't change my eye color just like that. You know, I can't change my metabolism like that. It can't happen, even if I wanted to for myself. And absolutely, the things that we can theoretically change, we probably will come to change, because it's in nobody's interest that we've spent decades and decades of human life to find this information, to now have a tool and not to use it. And absolutely, it can be frustrating that it's not happening at the correct pace, but I am behind it, but I don't know that I think that this is the most productive way of doing it.
I think I would just add that I think, you know, this is a really exciting technology. There are lots of very exciting technologies out there, but you know, I think it's important that we know what the technologies actually do and how they can be used in a safe and effective manner. And to that end, regulators can actually help us achieve that goal.
Special thanks this week to Josiah Zahner, Ganesh Taylor and Patty Zettler. If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.